Protection.
Manténgase en la sintonía de CKUT, nuestro próximo programa de International Radio Report.
Stay tuned to CKUT, next the International Radio Report.
Tengan todos ustedes un feliz domingo.
Have a happy Sunday.
I'm David Bochner of Guelph, Ontario, and I get my weekly radio news on the International Radio Report on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Welcome, everyone, to the International Radio Report for Sunday, January the 15th, 2023. My name's Sheldon, and Jill is with me, as usual, here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We thank you for tuning in. You can reach us by email, radioreport@yahoo.com. We have a Facebook group. It is called International Radio Report. We had another boost in membership this week. A lot of new members. We want to welcome Frank, Joe, Dennis, Dale, Jeffrey, Murugavaral, Frank, Prabhakara, Ken, Amit, and Nathan, bringing us to 888 members. You can find us, just simply search for International Radio Report on Facebook. I think you'll enjoy the group, lots of great information there, and you can interact with other members as well. And you can listen to our show a couple of different ways, either live on the radio on Sunday mornings or live streaming and archived at ckut.ca, CKUT's website. And of course, our YouTube channel, where you can listen to the program at your leisure, youtube.com/@IRR, and you can subscribe there as well. We have 766 subscribers. We will start the show off today with a couple of local stories and then take you to the end of the world with with one of the stories as we head off into Norfolk Island down in the South Pacific. Starting, though, in Montreal, we have a story from Steve Faggy's Fagstein blog. Jeremy White leaves The Beat 92.5. The Beat is the number one English music station in Montreal. And Jeremy White is a local kid from the Mohawk Reserve of Ganawagi in outside of Montreal, who has been the evening host at The Beat 92.5 just about since its launch. Well, he is no longer at the station. White tells Steve that he left on his own accord and decided in November that he didn't want to work a shift that started at 7 p.m. anymore, and the company wasn't interested in letting him voice track his show earlier in the day. The Beat had already scrubbed all references to him on its website, and the generic Montreal's Perfect Mix is now listed in his time slot. White is still on Chorus-owned Energy 93.5 in Toronto in the same time slot, and his Jeremy White Show podcast and YouTube channel is still active. He tells Steve that while he isn't looking for other radio work at the moment, he's open if someone wants to suggest another gig that can be voice tracked. But going to a station and doing a shift just ain't in the cards for me anymore. Sounds like COVID doesn't want to leave the house anymore, maybe, or something. Very strange. Several people, including one of White's former program directors at The Beat, have noted that White would seem to be a good fit for Shom FM, Montreal's rock music station, when you consider that he's more hard rock musical taste. But nothing has ever materialized on that front, and there's no indication that anything ever will. But he does have a website available, and he's doing voiceover work and what have you. So they do say if someone at Bell Media wants a new voice for a weekend rock station countdown show, one just became available. So Jeremy White, I should say, is out there and available.
Another rock voice would be a good idea in Montreal.
I'm very surprised that The Beat didn't want him to voice track, especially in evening hour slot. It's not prime time, you know, when you normally want live people in prime time. A lot of stations don't want people on in the sort of the off hours. So I find that a little odd with The Beat not wanting him to voice track.
Yeah, that's definitely bizarre. The CRTC once again threatens Montreal's Haitian radio station with license revocation. So this is by Steve Faggy from the Faxteen blog. The commission has concerns regarding the licensee's ability and commitment to operate the station in a compliant manner. With that standard phrasing, the CRTC is once again threatening Montreal radio station CJWI 1410 AM CEPAM Radio Union with revoking its license over repeated failure to meet license conditions. The owners of the station and two others in similar situations, CICR-FM in Parsborough, Nova Scotia, and CKVM-FM Ville-Marie, Quebec, have been called to appear at a hearing on April 5th to explain why their licenses should be renewed despite their repeated failures, including in their current license terms. The station's last license renewal came in 2020, along with several mandatory orders requiring it to comply with its conditions of license, and just after the commission refused to renew the license of sister station CGMS 1040. The latest apparent failure, CJWI still being given the chance to explain how they are still in compliance, relate to a regulation requiring they provide a complete and accurate list of all musical pieces played on the air, and a requirement that at least 35% of non-pop music played be Canadian. In correspondence with the commission, CJWI blamed the former on software it was using that did not count musical selections played for less than 12 seconds, and blamed the latter on the difficulty of finding Canadian specialty music of interest to the Haitian community. If CJWI is found to be in non-compliance again, it would be the fifth consecutive license term in which the station is not complying with its license conditions. And it would be the second consecutive license term in which it has failed to comply with a mandatory order requiring it to respect the regulation about having a complete and accurate music list. These are very serious matters, and the CRTC can't just let them go and maintain credibility as a regulator. But revoking CJWI's license or refusing to renew it might not be the best thing for the broadcasting system. There isn't much demand for AM frequencies these days. 1040 AM remains vacant, and this is the only station specifically serving the Haitian community. In a separate but related application also being heard in this proceeding, CJWI is asking the CRTC for amendments to its conditions of license regarding music quotas. Since the CRTC is saying it failed to meet those quotas, it is unlikely to grant such changes. Other stations are also in front of the commission to have their license renewed, but with less ominous stakes. They include Radio Ville-Marie, CIRA, FM 91.3 in Montreal, which the CRTC says failed to meet Canadian and French language music quotas. The CRTC is accepting comments on these files until February 9th. Note that all information submitted, including contact information, becomes part of the public record. So many, many defaults, many, many problems, consecutive. They already had specific rules to follow also from the last time. It seems they're not doing anything about it. And, well, let's blame the computer.
And never mind, talk about being bold. They're going to go in there and try to defend themselves on those things. Plus, they want to ask for more changes to allow them to change what they're supposed to be doing. Man, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen with this one. I'm surprised CRTC's been as patient as they have been. This is going to be their fifth consecutive time where they've been called up on the carpet to answer to these non-compliance issues. I don't think the fact of them being on AM is going to make a difference, even though, as they say, the AM band is pretty vacant in Montreal, but still.
And, you know, you got to be careful because you got to show that you are, you know, in power and capable of taking decisions. Because if you just say, well, it's okay for now, but, you know, next time again and again, they'll have to do something about it at some point. That's definite. And, you know, in the past, we've seen stations with far less problems actually being shut down.
Yeah, the CJMS that they talk about on 10:40 here in Montreal. Also in Toronto, when they closed the University of Toronto's campus community station, because they didn't, do what was asked of them. So it's happened that they've pulled the plug on licenses. So this is going to be interesting to follow. The hearings will be coming up in April. And if anybody, listening to us does want to comment on it, you can go to the CRTC website and you can file interventions up until February the 9th. So next we head out to Atlantic Canada. And Gilles, this was a story you found by Stephen Webb from the CBC News. Atlantic Canada's radio pioneer, Fredericton's CFNB, went on the air 100 years ago. When Fredericton businessman J. Stuart Neal began to experiment with a small radio transmitter in his home, it's likely some of his friends and neighbors labeled him a dreamer. The year was 1922, and there were only a few functioning commercial radio stations in Canada, with none in Atlantic Canada. The federal government had only begun regulating radio that summer, and it wasn't long before the hardware store owner forked over the $5 it cost to purchase an amateur radio transmitter license. Neil was given the call letters 10AD, and his 10-watt transmitter took up a substantial amount of room in his home's parlor on Waterloo Row. Outside, he installed a 10-meter mast on the roof of his house and a second 20-meter mast in the backyard, which were connected by a 4-strand aerial array. On January the 12th, 1923, he turned on his transmitter and began to broadcast for the first time. Neil wasn't broadcasting to a big audience, just a handful of people who lived near his home. Few New Brunswickers could afford a radio receiver, let alone had a reason to buy one in a community with no radio being transmitted. So Neil began with just a few hours of programming a day, consisting of commentary and news he performed himself, and music from a gramophone record player. In an edition of the Canadian Broadcaster dated January 23, 1958, CFNB's then station manager Jack Fennedy related an early story of Neil's broadcast experiences. One day his listeners were suddenly greeted by dead air in the middle of a broadcast. Only when the family telephone started to ring, Fennedy wrote, and the half dozen radio homes reported the break in the program, did the Neal family discover that the head of the house lay prostrate on the floor. Neal had apparently fainted, and the microphone was still open beside him. Having a radio station in your home wasn't easy for the family. They were sworn to silence when the radio was transmitting, learning to communicate using sign language. As the station increased in power and moved from an amateur to a commercial station, Neil hired an engineer and other announcer, and the family often had extra mouths to feed at the breakfast table. The hours of operation expanded with a mid-afternoon break at 3 p.m. each day to allow the transmitter batteries to recharge for the evening programming. That meant longer imposed silences for Neil's wife and two children. Eventually, Neil persuaded both the provincial and federal government's agriculture departments to buy advertising on his station, the first paid advertising on what was now known as CFNB. By now, it was clear the station had outgrown the house. So there's a guy that was very persistent, very determined to put something on the air when radio was in its infancy, something totally new to the people of the Maritime Provinces in Canada.
Man, it must have been so much fun to see all of those stations, how they started, the equipment used, how they would do it back in the day. I actually looked, a $5 license fee for 1922 is $73 today in actual money.
Wow. I think you'd pay a little bit more today for a broadcasting radio license.
Oh, yeah. We're in the thousands and thousands today, that's for sure. So what's happening with our sun? Well, it's really active. There's a bunch of sunspots that are creating a host of solar flares. What's interesting is that there were some pictures on Space Weather showing that every sunspot group on the solar surface was actually doing flares, sometimes almost like chained together one after the other. It was really amazing to see that. And so lots of M flares, a few X flares. Of course, that bumped up the solar flux to a number we haven't seen in a long time, 212. It's pretty amazing. That means that the ionosphere is, of course, charged even more. Signals of very high frequencies propagate a lot better. 10-meter band, I mean, is solid and open. It's pretty amazing what you get. And the higher frequencies have been shutting down a lot later, a few hours after sunset. So it's really the time to tune around the bands, to use your ham radio and go and make contacts. It's just amazing. The sunspot number is 151. And the conditions for the week to come will pretty much remain the same, as all of these sunspot plus new groups are actually popping up that are very active also. I would expect more flaring and more activity this week. And the only way that you can actually measure and listen to those conditions is to turn on a radio and listen.
This is Jeff Eichner of Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, United States of America. Listen to the International Radio Report with Sheldon and David every Sunday morning at 10:30 on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
So we've got a story about mysterious antennas that keep popping up in Utah's foothills, and no one knows why. This is by Catherine Manny, Global News. Public lands officials in Utah have a bona fide mystery on their hands. Electrical rigs consisting of an antenna, solar panel, and locked battery box keep popping up on mountain peaks and ridges in the foothills around Salt Lake City, and they have no idea why. Officials say they have spotted about a dozen of the devices scattered in the area. One antenna array was even set up at the summit of Mount Wire, which is more than 7,000 feet high, or 2,130 meters. These towers have been bolted into different peaks and summits and ridges around the foothills, says City Trails manager Tyler Fonero in an interview with local KSL-TV. It started with one or two, and now it might be as much as a dozen. About a year ago, city workers first started noticing the strange setups, which may call to mind the monoliths that appeared in Utah and around the world in 2020. Funero said that at the time, they didn't really take the antenna seriously. "We didn't really have the bandwidth to look into it or remove them," he said. In the past few months, many more devices were found, including on property managed by the Forest Service and the University of Utah. It's unclear who's installing them, but whoever they are, they don't have permits. "We just don't leave things on the public lands anymore. You have to ask for permission." There were no identifying marks on the antennas, but officials may learn more once they open the locked battery boxes. "We honestly didn't even open the box," Funero said, noting that the antennas had been bolted into the stone and needed to be removed with special tools. "We just wanted it off the hill." So far, two of the antennas' rigs have been removed by the city workers, but Funero said that the winter weather and snowy conditions make finding and removing the devices difficult. A third rig is slated to be removed in the coming weeks. "It's not a high priority for us," he said. On January 3rd, Salt Lake City Public Lands asked for help identifying the unauthorized solar panel towers in the foothills. "If you have information about these towers or who they belong to, please call our office at 801-972-7800 so we can return them back to their owner. Thanks," the organization wrote in a Facebook post. The University of Utah has stated that the devices are not, to their knowledge, connected with any research from the campus community. Since Salt Lake City leaders alerted the University of Utah to the unauthorized solar panel towers in the foothills northeast of the Avenues neighborhood, University of Utah representatives have been actively coordinating with city public lands official to determine whether any member of our campus community is connected to the towers. "As far as we know, the towers located on university property is not owned or operated by university," a spokesperson said for the university told KSL-TV. One theory that might explain the purpose of the antenna towers is that they're being used to mine cryptocurrency. Helium is a type of cryptocurrency that relies on a wide network of antennas to provide coverage. The wider someone's network, the more tokens they can mine. According to a report, helium miners can use online articles to learn how to create solar-powered rigs and deploy them in rural areas. A Reddit page for Ilium miners also shows user bragging about the elevation at which they set up their antennas. Funero said that so far he has noticed no damage to public lands relating to the antenna towers, and it's unclear if anyone will ever face charges for the unauthorized equipment. As long as it's not dangerous, we really don't care, he said. We just want people to stop doing it so we can get back to taking care of our lands. If someone wanted to put an antenna in the exact same location for scientific purposes, we'd probably allow it. So this is really a mystery. And especially with the... I'm not sure I get the link between cryptocurrency mining and antennas in the foothills of everywhere. This is very bizarre.
I don't understand this cryptocurrency stuff at all. Never mind the radio connection to it. But this is really, really strange. Salt Lake City, outside of Salt Lake City, is pretty sparse territory. It's pretty wide open areas. And I was reading one other story about this, of the work that these people would have had to put out to get this equipment up a mountaintop, especially in winter. Yeah. And to install it, the equipment you'd need to bring with you to do the installation. This is pretty, complicated. They obviously want them there for a specific reason, and they're prepared to go through the effort to get them there. Just what they're being used for, hopefully they'll find out, what frequency they're using, where these batteries have come from. Somebody's obviously gone out and bought a whole bunch of batteries somewhere to put into these things, and the boxes and the antennas and the whole works. And I like mysteries. This is a good one. Yeah. We'll see if they come up with a solution for it, though. It's going to be fun to follow this one. A sad story has been making the rounds of the radio world over the last week, and it comes to us via Radio World by T. Carter Ross. Cuban journalist and Radio Havana Cuba broadcaster Arnie Coro has died at the age of 80. The Cuban radio broadcaster, journalist, and DXer Arnaldo de Jesus Coro Antich, known to listeners as Arnie Coro, passed away early January the 8th, 2023, at the age of 80. He was well known for his twice weekly program DXers Unlimited on Radio Havana Cuba, Cuba's English language shortwave service. He was an amateur radio operator as well, call sign CO2KK. Coro became interested in radio as a child, and at the age of 12 joined the Radio Club de Cuba, or Amateur Radio Association. In 1957, he began working as a journalist at Canal 7, CMBF-TV. During the Cuban Revolution, he was one of the founders of Radio Havana Cuba in 1961, working to help set up the station's first transmitter ahead of the Bay of Pigs invasion. In 2017, Coro was honored with the National Radio Award by state broadcaster Radio Cubana. Over the years, Coro produced a number of science and technology radio programs for Juventud Rebelde, Radio Progreso, Radio Taino, and Radio Metropolitana, as well as for the magazine Juventud Tecnica. He also authored the 1984 book La Guerra Radial de los Estados Unidos de America contra Cuba, the United States Radio War Against Cuba. Coro was always passionate about ham radio. He was an active member of the Federación de Radio Aficionados de Cuba, and he worked tirelessly to help other broadcasters overcome technical problems. He also was sought to highlight the important role of amateur radio operators during emergencies. And at the time of his death, he served as emergency coordinator for Area C of Region 2 of the International Amateur Radio Union. He was an assistant professor at the Raul Roa Garcia Higher Institute of International Relations and served as vice president of UNESCO's Cuban Commission for the Preservation of Audiovisual Heritage. And I think every shortwave listener out there probably recognized the Arnie Coro CO2KK and his very popular DXers program, which was called DXers Unlimited.
Which was kind of fun. It was like a laid-down, relaxed guy talking about radio. It was not like those professional sounding radio shows we hear on all the broadcasters.
Yeah, he was a technical guy, and he liked to talk about antennas and his famous TTFD antenna that he always talked about. What was that? The folded dipoles, something terminated folded dipole. He was a character. Our CIDX vice president and QSL column editor, Mickey Delmich, had a chance to visit Cuba a number of years ago. Back and actually was invited to Arnie Coro's home, and they got to meet and sit down and speak with him at that time. So a lot of people very sad to hear of his passing, but lived to be 80 years old, so a pretty good life in Cuba.
Yeah, definitely, and he will be missed from Radio Havana, Cuba, that's for sure. From Nick Hacko, VK2DX, VK9DX of New South Wales, Australia, testing Radio DX from Norfolk Island. This is via Glenn Hauser's World of Radio IO Group. So it says, hi all, a low-key event, so please keep your enthusiasm curbed. In the next few hours, I will try to put a signal on 5045 kHz. Not a programming of any kind, rather an attempt to see how the new antenna is performing. There will be a song or two, station ID, every now and then, local time is 30 minutes to sunset, but it appears that I am making over to New Zealand. The test has been heard by several DXers around the world about between 07 and 11 hours UTC. As you were mentioning, a lot of people using Lamont Alberta Kiwi SDRs because they are really good at this.
Yeah, the signal is low powered, and if you look up Norfolk Island on a map, you're going to have to look hard to begin with, but it is way down in the South Pacific. But he's done this in the past of putting a small broadcast transmitter on the air, and he's there again now testing it out. We have an update that just came into us as we're recording the show. Another test was done on Friday morning on 5045, and a number of people hearing it, mostly in Western North America, people in New Zealand, Australia. I'm not sure when he'll be testing again, but keep watching all the DX spots and whatever. Interesting, the station ID that he was putting on, he had an ID done by Glenn Hauser that he was broadcasting. So some people heard Glenn's voice on those test transmissions as well. There have been ham operations in the past, but to have a broadcast on shortwave would really be something pretty special.
So we have upcoming ham radio contests.
We start out this next weekend, actually, with the NTC CUSO party, 1900 to 2000 hours Zulu, January the 19th. That's organized by the Netherlands Telegraphy Group, 80, 40, and 20 meters, and it is CW only.
There's the Pro DG Contest, 1200 Zulu, January 21st to 1159 Zulu, January 22nd, organized by the Pro DG Contest Club of Romania. It's 80 through 10 meters, and the mode is PSK63.
There will be a Hungarian DX Contest, 1200 Zulu, January 21st to 1159 Zulu, January the 22nd. It's organized by the Hungarian Radio Amateur Society, 160 through 10 meters, and this one will be both of CW and SSB or phone.
There's the North American QSO Party, SSB, 1800 Zulu to January 21st to 0559 Zulu, January 22nd, organized by the National Contest Journal, bands 160 through 10 meters in SSB.
That's going to be a busy one. Yep. That's a big, big contest. And if you're into VHF contesting or any frequencies above 6 meters and above, ARRL's January VHF contest, 1900 Zulu, January 21st, 0359 Zulu, January 23rd, organized by the American Radio Relay League. All amateur bands at 6 meters and up. All legal modes are permitted. CW, SSB, MSK144, FT8, FM, PSK31, FSK441, and JT65. Pretty much anything you want to do, 6 meters yep. and above on the ham bands. And that's a fairly long contest as well. So there'll be a lot of activity going on with all those different modes filling up the VHF, UHF spectrum.
And we are out of time.
We thank you for tuning in. Lots of interesting stories today. We'll have some of them posted up on the Facebook group, so you can go and join the group. Look for International Radio Report on Facebook and join, and you can get all the further details on these stories, plus other stories that we post up there that we don't get to. So that will do it for us. Have a great week, and we hope you will tune in to us again next week for our next edition of the International Radio Report on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Le matin, mon cadran est à CKUT. Pendant le déjeuner, j'écoute CKUT. En me rendant au travail, j'écoute CKUT.
Pourquoi quelques jurés veulent tout créer?
Au travail, on écoute tous CKUT. Pendant que je prépare le souper, c'est CKUT. Plus tard, pour relaxer, je syntonise CKUT. Et dans mon lit, j'écoute encore CKUT.
CKUT! CKUT!
Je capote sur toi.
Tout ça au 90.3 FM. À Montréal.
I slept too little and drank too much. What's my hypnosis anyway? Get out of bed like this. Oh, Christ.
Rise and shine with CKUT 90.3 FM.
Donna didn't come into the office today?
No, she's got a fever.
Aww, that's so thoughtful.
A woman of principle.
She even wears a mask to the mall and washes